It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here with fellow producer Megan Clougherty. This is the second part of our interview with Ben Wickler, who's the co-founder of The Flaming Sword of Justice, a podcast and a radio show that focuses on journalism activism. We ended up splitting this into two parts because the second half of the discussion was about Ben's relationship with Aaron Swartz, who, for those of you who know, was one of the co-founders of Reddit. He had gotten into some legal troubles and he committed suicide. So we talked to Ben about his relationship with Aaron, what he felt was the legacy that Aaron had.
If you haven't listened to part one, it's funny and great, and it was a really strong podcast on its own, but we thought this would be a good way to break it off. And leading into this point he's making, we asked him about, you know, how he started the podcast and when he met Aaron.
You know, after working for Al Franken at Air America, I started imagining what I would do if I had a show of my own. And it was a cool kind of daydream that I would play with every so often. But it wasn't a real kind of, it didn't seem like an actual possibility. I didn't imagine how I could even find a path to being able to do it. And when I was working at Avaaz, my central focus for a long time was climate change. There was this period where it seemed like the world and the U.S. were ready to really tackle climate change in a huge way, that kind of culminated and then crashed in the end of 2009 with this global climate summit in Copenhagen, and 2010 when the U.S. didn't pass a climate bill. But during that time, I was living in Cambridge. My wife was in graduate school, and I was working from this kind of former fraternity house that had been, I think it was like
lost. It was the Deltas, was it?
It was the, what's that?
The Deltas from Animal House. Anyway,
yeah, it was kind of like that, but it had done something so bad, and I don't know what it was, that it had lost its like accreditation or something, and it had to sell in a fire sale. And kind of very progressive friend of mine had found some investors and like bought it and turned it into a kind of co-working space for little nonprofits that were trying to make the world better. So I was working from this room where the window didn't quite close, which is kind of a problem in the winter, but we'd like put a space heater in and there was a big crack in the wall, but it was great and it was not very expensive, and I could, you know, I had a person I was working with and could do my Avaaz thing from there. And then a guy moved into the room next to mine, and Ian, who owned the house, the place is called the Democracy Center, you should go visit if you're in Cambridge, he introduced me to Aaron, and he's like, this is Aaron Swartz, he helped start Reddit, he like helped create RSS, and he's started this new thing called the Progressive Change Campaign Coalition, which is an activist group he was involved with. You guys would like each other. And we clicked right away, in a really big way.
Yeah,
I was doing all this other stuff, but I was also kind of a huge like tech nerd. And for some reason, I just couldn't stop reading like tech blogs. Like whenever I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing, I'd probably be on like Tech Meme looking at, you know, what the newest chapter in the Google-Apple patent war was or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Aaron was actually like a major figure in that world, and vice versa. Aaron was just moving into activism, and this was like my total, you know, this was the bubble that I was in. And so we kind of we developed a kind of immediate friend crush on each other and started hanging out and trading books and things to read. And in the course of about a year, realized that we had this common interest in storytelling. We were both obsessed with Robert Caro's books about Lyndon Johnson and the Power Broker, just amazing books. We both loved This American Life. And eventually I started telling him about this idea that I had for a show that would combine all these different things. And Aaron, like I'd been talking to friends and family and stuff about this for a while. Aaron was the first person I met who not only was like, that's a really interesting idea. He was like, let's do this together. And for me, that was a sea change. Like, first of all, that someone wanted to. And second of all, that Aaron did. Because Aaron, for folks that don't know, Aaron was just one of the most brilliant people in kind of the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. He was 14 when he helped create RSS. He was one of the co-authors of the RSS specification, which is how websites talk to each other, basically. And then he was like a computer prodigy and an entrepreneur and an amazing, beautiful, fluid writer and organizer and activist. He played a huge role in the giant campaign that stopped SOPA, the internet, some people call it internet censorship bill. And that was before the SOPA fight, actually, that we started talking. And so we started brainstorming and imagining this together. And in, I guess it was like the spring of 20, when did he actually decide to do this? It was like the winter of 2010 to 2011. I think right before he was arrested, we like decided we were really going to do this together. And so we started making these plans. And then one day Aaron arrived at the office just white as a sheet. He'd just been arrested by like Secret Service agents and local police for something that, you know, I don't know, but I don't really think that he knew. I don't think that he thought that what he was doing was actually illegal. I think that he thought that he was getting around some like annoying network settings at MIT, but he had downloaded all these journal articles and then suddenly was facing this incredible prosecution. And it was really, it was like the crazy moment. But at the time, like he thought that they might drop the case or who knows what.
Can you explain just for people who don't know what
sure.
happened?
Yeah, yeah. So in fall of 2010, actually around the same week that Aaron started the fight that eventually beat SOPA, he went to MIT where he had a lot of friends and worked on a bunch of projects mm-hmm. and started downloading the entire library of this journal database called JSTOR. So JSTOR is a nonprofit that was set up by a bunch of universities to create online copies of journal articles. And when they started it, no one else was doing that, and no one knew how you could get all these journal articles online. It was kind of a helpful service.
Right.
But over the years, it's kind of become this – it's almost become a wall against people getting access to these journal articles because you have to pay thousands of dollars in subscription fees to access these, you know, this academic research that was generally funded by public institutions, by universities, by government grants. And the authors of the journal articles don't, you know, almost to a person would rather have their articles available to everyone. And Aaron had been involved in some kind of conferences and meetings of people trying to work with JSTOR to figure out how to get these articles into the public domain. Mm-hmm. And all those efforts had failed to work. And right before this, he'd gone to Hungary and he'd met all these researchers from developing countries who could not access any of this research because their universities didn't have the money to pay the subscription fees. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, thought that was an outrage. And I think, you know, I think it, there's a sense in which everyone would say it would be better if the world were set up so that when someone does a great piece of research, it's available to everyone. It's mm-hmm. just a question of like, can we figure out the institutional arrangements to make that work?
Right.
So Aaron was somebody who, you know, had a very, very strong kind of feeling of moral obligation in the world. And he also didn't have an allegiance to particular institutional structures. He mm-hmm. thought that they were important insofar as they made the world better, but he mm-hmm. didn't feel,
if yeah. they were limiting, then
yeah, he thought if they were making things worse for everybody, and it didn't hurt anyone to change them, then he just should. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that he, I mean, I wouldn't have believed it if someone had told me that downloading these articles would result in ultimately 13 felony indictments and a possible 50-year prison term and a prosecutor who's in his plea negotiations refused to consider anything that didn't result in a felony conviction. And so. Anyway, so Aaron started downloading these articles, and the MIT, we now know the MIT network got, or the JSTOR servers got overloaded, and they cut off MIT's access to the articles, and it caused a kind of like internal, you know, alert, mm-hmm. alarm within MIT and JSTOR. But Aaron kind of got around their attempts to stop him. He downloaded millions of articles, and then they decided to start a stakeout, which it turns out that MIT, maybe too much detail, but MIT decided to call the police instead of just using their campus security or whatever. And by coincidence, those Secret Service guy and I think the like computer crimes prosecutor were at the police station when they called. Mm. So it suddenly kicked up. To, yeah, it suddenly became this huge thing with all these different law enforcement people involved. And they set up a secret. Instead of just like when they figured out where how he was downloading the stories, they didn't just unplug the computer. They set up a security camera and like, you know, did a whole stakeout. And then when he came in to check on it, they chased him down in the middle of the street and, like, arrested him. He was strip searched. He was, like, you know.
Wow.
And then they
sounds like a movie.
Ransacked his apartment and, like, yeah, it was terrible. And Aaron was, so, like, I mean, it was really, it was devastating for him. It was really scary. And he, so he, like, immediately gave the articles back that he downloaded. And JSTOR was like, okay, we're as far as we're concerned, this is over. They didn't want to press charges. But MIT didn't do that. And the prosecutor wanted to. This is like a moment when the government was trying to go after WikiLeaks and not succeeding and Anonymous is happening.
This is a fish we've got on a hook. Let's land this one.
And so that sort of wound up being this cloud hanging over the period when the show started. So Aaron and I, you know, it was like that spring, my wife was pregnant. It was very exciting. And I like wanted to move to New York to start the show. And Aaron was like, let's do this. So we moved to New York City. And we were working at Avaaz. Avaaz gave us a grant to start developing it. We started working from the Avaaz office in Manhattan. And the week after we started, Aaron hadn't heard from the police for a while. And we were starting to fantasize that maybe they decided this actually wasn't going to go. And then they indicted him. And that was like the second week that we were working on the show together. So he had to go in a bus every week back to New York to like tell the judge that he hadn't fled. And we didn't know what, you know, we just didn't know what the future would bring in terms of what was going to happen to him.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know, we started working on this idea, and we worked for a few months. We originally thought we could do this as an online video thing. What we've learned since then is that no one's actually figured out a good business model for online video. Like, a lot of places are putting a lot of money into making online videos. Not a lot of people are
like my. It just drives me crazy. But we'll go into that another time.
Yeah.
This is like my thing.
This is not all about you, Megan.
I know. Sorry, guys.
We have a guest tangent. In our house.
Tangent.
No, it's an interesting thing because so many people are spending so much time working on it.
And nothing.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's almost nothing. So after a little while, we're like, well, what if we did this as radio or podcast? And we did like a trial run. It was really fun, just interviewing each other. And then we heard about this like little radio station that was going to get started in D.C., WeAct Radio. Mm-hmm. So then the due date of our baby started getting close. And we were like, we haven't figured this out yet, so let's get jobs. do something. But still keep talking. And so I went to change.org, and Aaron worked on projects with Avaaz and Change, actually, and then a place called ThoughtWorks. But then on New Year's Day of 2012, I got a call from this little radio station. And they were like, we're starting up. We've put you on at Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. Like, congratulations, you have a show. And I was like, this is amazing.
It's
like,
happening.
Yeah. And I was like, Aaron, this is what I want to do. And he's like, you need to do your job and take care of your kid also. But we started doing the show. Yeah, I know. So that for the first 5 months of 2012, every Sunday morning, Aaron would come over at like 8 a.m. on Sunday, which was neither of our favorite thing.
It sounds fun.
But we got La Bagel Delight, which is a wonderful bagel place on 7th Avenue in Brooklyn, to sponsor us. Yes. So we had a sponsor, and we get free bagels and cream cheese.
I love your commercials.
Thank you. Yeah, we started making radio ads for La Bagel Delight, which are all of our DC AM listeners, I'm sure, enjoyed. And we started doing this show, and it was like the most fun thing I'd ever done. And it was like a comedy outlet, which I hadn't had as much working on Zimbabwean democracy suppression stuff. And it was, I was interviewing people that I'd met in the course of doing the work that I'd done about, like, how did they pass a carbon tax in Australia after, like, the government was run by climate denialists, and mm-hmm. how did they stop the West Side Stadium? These different kind of fight stories. And we were doing a fair amount of comedy at that time as well. And it was both clear to me that, like, this is actually the thing, and, like, this is what I wanted to do, this is what I felt called to do, and that I couldn't do this the way that I wanted to do it and have this other very, intense and great job and have this baby and family. And I wasn't going to lose the baby and family. Those were very important to me. So I started trying to figure out how I could actually do this as a job. And by the fall of 2012, I'd come up with this new idea. I pitched MoveOn. By that point, Aaron, was getting close to his trial, and we sort of hadn't, like, it didn't seem like he was going to, there was no way to imagine a way that he could, commit to being part of the next chapter with me, because his trial was scheduled for January originally. Mm. But it was on its way to happening. And then the first day, actually, that I started like sitting down to plan out the new show in January was the day that Aaron committed suicide. And so this year's been really hard. Yeah. It's both, like, at a personal level, my wife finished her PhD and my son is just amazing and wonderful, and I'm doing this thing that's been my dream for so long. But it also started with the hardest time that I've ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. And for several months, I was totally consumed by what had just happened.
Mm-hmm. Especially because you guys started it together. So it seems weird that it was like just taking off without him.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many levels of it, because it was both everything I do related to the show. He's in the room. Like, right. There's all the, like, I'm digging up documents that he and I wrote together, and there's all these all this stuff that he and I built. His estate still owns the URL, findingsortofjustice.com. Mm-hmm. So like whenever there's this long proceeding to be able to transfer it out of his estate, and whenever we need to change a minor setting, we have to contact his digital trustee to, like, he's still He's still very much a part of it.
Mm-hmm. He was the guy who said, you could do this.
And he said, I could do it. He, like, I was so scared of it, and he just talked me out of every fear that I had. He was, you know, ironically in a way now, but he was just the most fearless person I knew and willing to go out on a limb to do things that he thought were great and things that he thought were important. And there are actually a lot of people who have these stories about him kind of convincing them that their dream could actually be a real thing and changing their lives. And he really did that for me. I still, like, while he was, right after he was indicted, while he was facing this giant, possible prison sentence, all this stuff, he and I would be sitting in a room, and I'd be like, you know, what if the show sucks? What if, like minor concerns? And he would be like, just patiently talking me out of them and saying, like, you got to go for it and try it.
It's amazing when you meet somebody who's fearless, pretty much, and, you know, change your perspective, because you're always feeling insecure and something's not going to work. But when you realize that fear is something you can get by.
Yeah.
It's quite a revelation.
It really is.
So are you intentionally now working him into the show?
His spirit is present in a million parts of it. At the end of every show, I do the credits, and he's always the founding producer. Mm. And I have a big picture of him in the studio. Mm-hmm. So he's really there. What happened was, after he died, when I relaunched The Spring, I just didn't have, like, I think that's another reason why the show wasn't funny at that point. Like, The Spring, I've done a lot of shows that I'm really proud of, but I wasn't feeling like writing, like,
comedy. Yeah.
And
understandably.
Yeah. And I think now it's been, like, I guess 10 months now. And now I'm starting to, like, feel ready to make the show that we originally dreamed of and that I've wanted to do.
Is that the reason for the relaunch? Just to sort of, like, give it a new start?
Yeah. Yeah. There's, like, the options are, go to episode 65 of The Flaming Sword of Justice, now with a new format, new studio, new all this stuff.
Right.
Or to, like, have it be reborn. And that just feels like the right thing to me. Like, I want it to, to take off in its own sense, as opposed to just have another nudge of something we've been doing.
What do you see as Aaron's legacy, not just for the podcast, but just, let me back up before I ask that question. I think anybody who has sort of been, whose head has been in the digital space the last couple of years is aware of who Aaron Schwartz was. And, you know, I can't say I did not know him. I did not know what his impact was and his legacy was. I only saw what people were saying about him. And it was difficult for me because I hadn't followed every aspect of his life, you know, so I didn't understand necessarily what he had done and what the impact was, what his legacy was, and the importance of who he was. What do you see as his legacy? And at the same time, what do you think is the main misconception that people might have about him?
So I think the main misconception is that he was fundamentally a kind of, like, hacktivist.
Like an anarchist or
something. Like, he was an anarchist, all information must be free, kind of, you know, data liberator. that's what he, that was the core of his life. He had, some of his projects had some of that flavor, but actually he, believed that some system of copyright and intellectual property were important. Just that the one that we have right now is crazy. And it's hard to find someone who has studied it and wouldn't agree with that to some extent. The thing that I think is fundamentally Aaron's legacy, and the thing that after he died, we got the most kind of messages from people. We set up a memorial site where people could post remembrances. And we got floods of messages from people that had never met him, had just read his writing or learned about him after his death. The thing that seemed to touch people the most was actually the sort of fundamental idea that the best way to live your life is in service of your ideals. And that, you know, Aaron had walked away from a huge amount of money when he left Reddit very quickly after it was launched. He was unhappy, and he wanted to do something bigger in the world. Depending on how you look at the story, he engineered his own firing or left or was pushed out. But he moved away from that, and he had lots of ideas that could have generated huge amounts of money. And there's an unfortunate kind of ethos that some folks in Silicon Valley have, that anything that gets millions of people to use it and makes a lot of money is changing the world, as though that's the way to measure positive impact in the world. Mm. And Aaron just was never captured by that at all. Mm. He was relentlessly curious, and he was relentlessly searching, and he had a kind of moral seriousness where he was really trying to build his life in the way that could serve humanity the most. And that is, it's deeply inspiring. And there's so many different kind of projects and things he touched that was expressed by. His interest in copyright and digital freedom was one of them, but then he was deeply involved in, like, you know, the healthcare reform fight and Dodd-Frank when he was, you know, doing activism stuff. Lawrence Lessig was his mentor starting when he was about 14, or became a close friend. And Lessig has said repeatedly that he had sort of started as Aaron's mentor, but Aaron wound up becoming his mentor. Lessig had become the world's foremost guy on copyright reform. And in, you know, a couple of years of intense kind of arguments and conversations with Aaron convinced him that there were bigger issues, there were bigger problems in the world. And Lessig now looks at kind of institutional corruption more broadly, and he looks at, you know, failures of the political system. And he's sort of taking on bigger fights because Aaron opened his mind to this bigger picture in the world. Like, mm-hmm. I really feel like Aaron was just at the beginning of his own journey through the, you know, through this planet. And he mm-hmm. was thinking much more at a global scale. He was in touch with activists in South Africa and India and, you know, people around the world who were struggling with enormous problems that, you know, Aaron had different kinds of capacities he could have offered them. He was building software for activists who had no money, you know, to be able to do digital activism the way that people do in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess it's fundamentally that inspiration that it's not about sort of personal glory or money, that what really counts is what you can offer to the world. I think that's his most fundamental legacy. And what happened for me actually is that after his death, I had a period where I thought maybe I should just put the show on hold and focus on trying to, you know, change the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was one of the laws he was prosecuted under. It was a crazy law, which we can talk about. You know, maybe I should try to dedicate myself to something else. And then I realized that in a way the show is actually the biggest tribute that I can pay to him. Because mm-hmm. part of the kind of idea of the show is that by telling the stories of people who do this kind of thing with their lives, we can inspire other people to do the same. And the really big shift is how do we move our culture towards one of service and, you know, belief in the sort of fundamental equality of people's equal worth. Mm-hmm. How do we move our politics towards a recognition that everybody matters? And the show was our kind of moonshot idea about how to do that. And that's the sense in which, for me, my work now is dedicated to his memory and also to the animating spirit that I think ultimately connected the two of us from the beginning. Right. This idea that that's what we could try to do in the world.
So let's just sort of wrap this up in talking specifically about the show. You know, how can people listen to it? I mean, is it a local station here, but is it something that's going to be streamed?
Sure. So we had been streaming it live on the web, podcast, on local radio, and Stitcher, and all these things. We're actually going to change the name now, which is a...
What?
I would say 95% chance we're going to change the name. Let me sort of address this. I love, but it's very long, and it's for people who don't already know what it is, it's very confusing.
It
sounds more like a kind of Dungeons & Dragons or fundamentalist Christian thing. So, name TBD, but fundamentally it's
going to
be...
Don't call it TBD. Please, anyway,
my show named TBD.
It's a sensitive topic.
That's another podcast.
So if you but certainly you'll be able to find it if you go to flamingsortofjustice.com or fsj.fm or look for separate words Flaming Sort of Justice on iTunes. You can find the podcast. It's
or
on
Ben
Stitcher.
Wickler.
Yeah, or search for Ben Wickler, Wickler. It's on Stitcher. It's on anywhere that you can find kind of recorded audio online. We're going to try to make sure it's there.
Cool.
And down the road we might pursue syndication or what have you. But we are the number one Google hit for Flaming Sword of Justice, believe it or not.
Nice.
So not hard to find that way.
Can I ask Ben one more question?
Please do.
Do you feel good about where journalism, like activism, is going? Or, like, you know, sort of your corner of the journalism world, do you feel like that's going in the positive direction and it's growing?
The thing that I'm really pleased about is that there's a sense, I think, especially in a younger generation of journalists, that you can be fair and still have a point of view. That, you know, you can be honest with the information that you present. You can even give both sides of issues, but you don't have to, you know, I think that there's a huge and crucial role as part of the news ecosystem for people that are just straight down the line, you know, reporting information. But there's, you know, a lot of journalists who want to present, like, you know, who think that one side has more, you know, merit to its arguments and can explain why. And I think there's actually a really big service to the kind of to the public to be able to get an analysis that way. I think, like, what Ezra Klein is doing with Wonk Blog, it's not activism, it's very much journalism, but it, you know, presents an analysis that you can agree or disagree with in a useful way. My problem with conservative media is not so much that there are people with conservative values, it's that conservative media so often just distorts the underlying reality of stuff. And I don't think all conservative journalists do that by any means. I think someone like Ross Douthat is, you know, is really fair with his analysis. I just disagree with some of his conclusions.
But it has that reputation, you're saying.
Yeah. Well, like if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, you'll just hear a lot of things that aren't true. And I think what I'm pleased about is that there's now a kind of a rainbow of straight fact gathering and news reporting, and also real information plus analysis. And then that, I think creates an environment where there can also be people doing the kind of thing that I'm doing, where we, give information, we tell stories, and we ask people to do stuff. I think the biggest danger in journalism as in agriculture is monoculture, right? It's where it's a situation where you can't actually get a diversity of this stuff. And mm-hmm. I think there's a danger of that in the kind of filter bubble sense of people only consuming the stuff they already agree with. But I think it's now, at the very least, easier to be a broadly informed and engaged citizen than it's been for a long time, because there's so many different ways to different voices in the mix and different ways to get access to those.
This has been enlightening and cool.
Yes, yes. No, this is everything we like doing.
Well, really. Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Okay, take care.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.